Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me this week on Tia Time. We'll get to the show in just a moment. First, I wanted to say thank you to all of you who have posted a rating on Apple Podcast. Apple Podcast is an app that can be downloaded to your phone or computer. The algorithm it uses allows more artists and art enthusiasts like yourselves to hear about the show. So if you haven't posted a rating yet, do it now. Thank you. On with the show. Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, the weekly podcast where we discuss the methods, challenges, and real-life experiences of living our creative dreams. What kind of creative warrior are you? Musician, filmmaker, painter, choreographer, poet, sculptor, fashionista? Let's talk about it right now. I'm your host, Tia Imani Hanna. Today on Tia Time with Artist is my most esteemed guest and friend, Mary Foster Conklin, who is a marvelous singer, interpreter of song, interpreter of lyric, interpreter of tone, and radio host of many years of a broad spectrum. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you so much.
Oh, so it's so good to have you here. It's so good to see you. We slogged it out in New York City for I was there for 11 years and Mary's still there. I'm back in Detroit now, but New York is something, and I know you've been going through it with COVID and everything. How has it been there? What's the atmosphere in the world there?
It's funny because now we're hitting sort of the anniversaries. As March began, I was like ticking off my fingers. March 6th was my last live gig. March 10th, I went to see Kate McGarry at the Jazz Standard. That was my last live club. March 16th, I met my accountant and did my taxes. And at the end of the day, my husband texted me from urgent care, running a high fever. And then the next day, the city shut down. We were in quarantine. 4 days later, he got a positive diagnosis. My mother, who was an assisted living across the river in Edgewater, they had shut down the first weekend of March. Oh, and the radio station, which is on the Fairleigh Dickinson campus in Teaneck, New Jersey, shut down March 15th. I had taken the subway up to the bridge to get to Jersey and got the email saying, don't come. Everything's locked down. And so when I did the club date, we were still cracking jokes. We were still like, yo, the end is coming. We don't care. Keep drinking. We're going to get through this. Bravado. Sure. But by, say, the middle of March, it was serious. And my husband, fortunately, did not end up in the hospital, did not end up on a ventilator. He had it bad enough. And we were doing the mask thing. And I was in the bedroom and he was in the living room and trying to do and washing and doing all that crazy stuff. And then a friend of mine called me who has like a syndicated radio thing. He at the time was still living in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and he just said, you need to stay on the air and I'm going to help you make the jump to pre-record your broadcasts and we're going to put you out there. And that was a gift because suddenly it was something I could do. All the pieces to put together a podcast with a radio broadcast, there's a lot to do. But it was also a way of thinking further than me. And going, because I have a whole thing, the stuff goes out on the air, but then it goes to the archive, which is on the Mixcloud site, mixcloud.com. And Mixcloud is fully licensed and pays artists when they get airplay. It's pennies to pennies, but there still was a way of doing some good, generating income for artists and to be on the air going, hello from the Bowen Bunker, live in New York City. Here we are. Right. My husband still has COVID. Trump is still president, but we are here and I'm broadcasting from my closet and that kind of stuff. I thrive on that. That's like singing off a fire escape.
You've done before.
Yes. And then to also just to be able to, on a weekly basis, go on the air and say all the artists that you hear. Don't just stream their music. Go to their websites, their band camps, their SoundClouds, their live streams. Buy their music. They need your help. And at the same time, people who had lost tours and gigs with new releases or were just poised to drop music. And what were they supposed to do? Your friend Gaylin McKinney. Mm-hmm. And so they would draw, they would reach out to me or I would reach out to them and I'd be like, what up with that? And they'd be like, oh, I've got a single. I said, if it's mastered, send it to me. I'll send it out. And it's been a way that helps keep my foot. And then when all this stuff was happening in New York on the riots and the street stuff and all the bad propaganda that was being generated, suddenly we became an anarchist jurisdiction. And it was just like, you are talking trash about my town. And you're in Detroit. Mm-hmm. You know how that feels.
It's yes. Like,
don't you dare. Don't you dare. And so then it became very important to be like, here we are in the anarchist jurisdiction and we are living our lives. We are going to the grocery store. We are cooking meals. We are trying to stay in touch with our loved ones. We are trying to do the right thing. And that was the other thing. My husband fortunately recovered in about 3 weeks. And then my mom, she had been in decline. She had just turned 91. She was in a wheelchair with end-stage heart failure. But it was that horrible thing. I just called it death by phone. I couldn't go. And fortunately, she had her head. And I could talk to her, but it was like a double whammy of almost losing my husband and then losing my mom. And so I was I'm a little gasping here. Don't mind me. And so it's been a time. I'm very grateful for the friends that only had friends of friends that were exposed and were dealing with other things like loss of livelihood and income.
Right, you know,
everybody now in my mind has a story to tell. And there is no going back. There's just doing all the things you can do to do as much as you can. And so it's been a challenge and a time. New Yorkers, it's unnatural to spend too much time in your apartment. That's not what New Yorkers do. My place is tiny and cramped and cluttered. And like I said, working at my desk is like being on a spaceship. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a challenge. And we were in these two little rooms for 10 months. Before we left to go to check the house in North Carolina thing. And by then we were out of our minds. I didn't realize how crazy we had become, house happy. But we weren't like, oh, we can go to our summer place and it'll all be fine. That's just not we don't even have a car. Yeah, we're New Yorkers. So. And the culmination of that leaving town, go pick up the rental car. You're washing your hands. You're doing all that shit. You're doing the driving back down to pick. I go to pick up my husband. He gets in the car. He looks at me and he goes, I broke the key off of the lock.
No.
I said, get in. We'll deal with it.
you're like outside skipping through the tulips. Throwing daisies in the air. La 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 la.
I remember getting texts, like New Year's texts from you when I was down in North Carolina taking care of my mother-in-law who is still alive.
Okay.
And that was before Zoom and all that kind of contact. And so a text from a friend was a welcome thing. We had dial-up till maybe a couple of years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
Now we've graduated to DSL. Hey, baby. All that stuff they tell you about rural internet, it's true.
True. But you have some space and a house and some outdoor space. And
We were there for 2 weeks in October. We came back to New York to vote and then hunkered down because my husband had some other surgeries as soon as he was, that was our summer project. My pandemic experience, not very sexy, one damn thing after another, but it could be, there've been some terrible, I went to get the second shot yesterday and I took the train all the way up to Washington Heights, which is, you know, where the armory is, the track and field. And I'm walking to get off the train and there was a little tiny graffiti on the wall and it just said, thank you, Mr. Subway, for letting me ride inside you. And I've been just photographing stuff like that, just going, New Yorkers are just that. I did that all summer when there was all this trash talking about the city. And there's been amazing graffiti. There's been amazing street art to see. And I just keep taking pictures and posting them.
That's your new book. And you laugh. Watch. It's going to come out. Next year, I'm going to see this book by Mary Foster Conklin, Photographs of the City.
Light up your lazy blue eyes. Moon's up, night's up, taking the town by surprise. Nighttime, nighttime, day left an hour ago. City light time, must you get ready so soon? Places to come from and places to go. Night in the city looks pretty to me. Night in the city looks fine. Music comes spilling out into the street. Colors go flashing in time. Take off. Take off, take off your stay-at-home shoes. Break off, shake off, chase off those stay-at-home blues. Stay away, down to the crowds in the street. They go their way, looking for faces to greet, while we go on laughing with no one to meet. Night in the city looks pretty to me. Night in the city looks fine. And the music comes spilling out into the street. Colors go flashing in time.
I've got so much respect for the artists of Detroit. There's incredible music in Detroit. And I've only been to Detroit once to do a gig at a college thing.
Okay.
But that thing of having the press talk about just all the negatives and what's bad about it, as opposed to who lived through New York in the bad old days, there was some of the most exciting art because you didn't have to worry about your rent. And yeah, and getting robbed was a when question, not an if question. But nowadays, the idea in New York of where do the artists live? How do they handle that? Mm-hmm. They go to Detroit.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, I think 2008, after that crash happened, pretty much almost everybody I knew, like a good 2/3 of the people I knew who were artists, all left. because they just couldn't afford it. And I'm still slogging it out. And at that point, I think I lost a job. And then I was on unemployment. I was like, what am I going to do? I moved to a smaller, horrible apartment. And then I said, I can't. I just can't do it. Because I had been in the same place for the whole time I was there. And then I had to move into this roach infested place. And I was like, and Coney Island, of all places. I was in Park Slope. Moved all the way
I remember
down
to that.
Coney Island. It was horrible. I was like, no.
For all of my friends that left and said and felt like somehow they had failed themselves, it was like, here's the secret. It's killing us. Mm-hmm. It's killing us. Mm-hmm. If you found a toehold somewhere else where you can thrive, you've done yourself a favor. Yep. And now with the internet that sort of makes everything much more accessible, you need a place where your head is happy and you can thrive.
Yeah, you remember that whole scene, because I had to give up my beautiful little place and you guys, I think you guys came over to sing for me for my last show that I did there. Yeah, that was a long time ago now. So
that was such a magic time because we all studied with Rhiannon.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, vocalists don't get a chance to jam together the way instrumentalists do.
Correct.
And the coolest thing about that legacy, Rhiannon was part of Bobby McFerrin's Voicestra, and she was an artist and an actor and also a champion improviser. But that thing of bringing together vocalists and making something out of nothing, spontaneous composition. Usually vocalists are turned against one another to battle for gigs, slots. It's insane. And now we were instrumentalists and being able to jam with one another. What you got? What do you hear? What's the groove? And people who had their strengths. And for me, it was such a game changer. And the people that were in that little group that Kate Geller, who now is in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Who is still singing online for 20 minutes. God bless her. She stubbornly kept that group going. And there is another group that has evolved since Kate left New York.
I think Ben is still doing it.
Ben is doing it. And they've moved onto Zoom and have generously shared all their technical knowledge of if you have no money, do this. If you have a little money, you can do this. Try this. Make sure you do that. And so that people can continue to work with what they've got. It's not my favorite. But I did a choir thing online, and that was interesting. That thing of you've got the music playing in your headphones, and you are singing to your phone, and you're trying to stay on pitch and do this thing. It was like, well, that's one school of thought.
But yeah, because you feel strange singing to yourself, but hey, it is what it is. They mix it later on and it comes out great. And you sound like you're singing with the choir. And if you have a good looking face and they videotape the whole thing, then you have to be on. It works.
Yeah, people were like, oh, I've thrown away my bra and I'm wearing sweatpants and I don't know how to use makeup anymore. And I was like, really? I guess I'm too old. I'm at that age where if you don't put on lipstick, you look like a dead person. So.
Well, it's definitely a habit. I was with my grandmother for the last 2 years of her life, and she put that on every day, and she put on everything every day. And she said because she had to keep her self-esteem. Hey, she lived to be 99.
God bless.
What am I going to tell her? She knows. You do what you have to do to keep your self-esteem.
I think daily rituals have become very important in the pandemic, quite frankly. I mean, it's as we pass this anniversary, I'm one of these people that like regularly journals, and you go back to the early days and when we thought it was going to be a couple of weeks, maybe a month or two. And it was like, oh, I'm doing affirmations. I'm, you know, taking Pilates online. Yeah, but it was the idea, if anybody had told me that it would have gone on for a year or more. I'm glad I didn't know. It's just been an interesting time for everyone.
True that. The funny thing is I actually did know because I did the research on the 1914 influenza pandemic. Mm-hmm. And they said it from the beginning, and the CDC said it's going to be a year to 2 years just for the, crowd immunity to come into effect. And we didn't have a vaccine. And with the way we weren't shutting down like all the other countries were, I said, well, we're going to go into 2 to 4 years because we won't shut down. So here we are. It's a year in. And we're in Michigan, we're seeing 50% jumps in the last week and last couple of days, more than the rest of the country, because for whatever reason, we're still not doing what we need to do in Michigan.
How is the vaccine situation there?
It's good, actually. I got my first shot yesterday, and we're at, I think, the third grouping or something like that, which is, I think it was essential workers first, and then people older than, I think, 70 and up, and then they went to 60, 50 to 60 or something like that, and we're in the next grouping, and they're going to be doing a big stadium thing. They're doing it at all the mm-hmm. universities are having stuff at their stadiums. So you just have to go. You have to get an appointment and you have to go.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing it. It's just people have to actually do it. So
the reading that I did about the pandemic of 1918, and I mean, it was frightening, mm-hmm. the parallels, the fact that the government did not have a working plan, that the government in some cases actively discouraged sharing knowledge, the fact that masking was an issue, that it became a political issue. It was about personal freedom. It was about, and with horrible consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just read that and you go, this was 100 years ago. We haven't learned anything.
No.
Not a thing.
So with that, we make more art.
I was just saying this to a friend of mine. It was like after the election, people, musicians, a lot of them were just, I'll see you in the practice room. I can't make sense of this bigger picture, but I think I need to go practice. And it's our reaction. I'll make art. I at least can do that.
It is what we're here to do. All of us, I haven't met a single artist who's, I'm not going to do this if this happens. There's nothing that can happen unless you have to switch to a different kind of art because something happens physically or something. But I don't know anybody who says, I'm going to just stop doing this because it's what we're meant to do. We can't do anything else but to make some kind of art. And I think people they're locked down. We're all getting fatter because we're cooking more and we're staying home and we're eating. We're stuffing some of the fear, but we're also creating things. And I say the same thing for scientists out there who are going through the same thing. Maybe they're creating a cure for something else that we've been fighting for forever. But now they have time to sit down and think about that problem.
There is also like an overlap with the AIDS crisis, which I was in New York for. And my dad worked at St. Vincent's Hospital, was a ground zero. And I can remember asking him to dig out medical records when partners could not have access because they weren't family. And it's just those kinds of things. It's a time. It's a moment in time. And I don't know. I'm almost grateful to be the age that I am with a little history. Like I've had my life explode a couple of times. I've had deep disappointments. I released a record the day after 9/11.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That sucked. Yep. It was not. And so when I would read about people who had like had tours canceled, I was just like, I always was guilty about it, but I remember watching those towers go down and I'm sitting there going, but my record. And you just, it's like that old t-shirt of the woman weeping going, nuclear war, there goes my career. What are you going to? And, but the thing is just life goes on. The year after that, my mother-in-law had a stroke and we were down in rural North Carolina mm-hmm. taking care of her and the farm. And artistic things present themselves in very strange ways. Yeah, I was always going to lick my wounds about that sort of lost album, which I thought was like my best work. But then I was like following a new thread about some obscure material of a lesser known writer of the Great American Songbook, and got mad because I had called a publisher for a lead sheet. And she was like, well, if Sinatra didn't record it, why should we have it on file?
Oh.
And then I got really mad and Irish temper and suddenly went on this tear on discovering that how much old music gets lost as ephemera. And because if Sinatra didn't record it, it gets judged as not significant. And we both know that's not so.
Not at all.
suddenly like getting into the wacky world of obscure music hounding and getting on a train to the Library of Congress and breaking open a box like Tut's tomb and finding 40 years of a composer's work and just going, oh, I have to do it. But it was a game changer for me because it changed. I am not a composer, but as far as the kind of material that I like, I always like to go back now that I'm doing this radio show that focuses on women composers and women writers. It takes me right back to the early days in New York when I would go to the Footlights record store on the Lower East Side on 12th Street. And I'd be picking through vinyl records. I'm so old. And I fell upon a collection called the Rosetta series by a woman, compiled by a woman named Rosetta Reitz. And she had a label called Rosetta Records, and she collected music from the public domain, women composers, women artists from the 20s and 30s. And that was where I heard Lil Hardin Armstrong and Lil Green and Valida Snow and Mary Lou Williams and Bessie Smith and all these people. And suddenly the 20s was this amazing time of women music. And then I found a book called the Book of the Blues. And it not only was like old blues, but it had a discography. So you could follow the thread going, this was originally recorded by Bill Brunsey, but it was also then recorded by Peggy Lee, who brought it into the white music world, you know. Right. So you could follow the journey of, say, a song that was written in the 20s. And to me, that just like floated my boat. I was like, this is cool. If you're not writing original stuff, I mean, the same 25 standards, they're perfect. But they get tired. It's just like, how many versions of Sunny Side of the Street can you listen to? And there's so many. And there's so many stories about these artists. And I had always said a woman singer should always have an evening of music written by women, whether it's new music like Carole King and Laura Nyro, Bjork, which got big, and or if it's Dorothy Fields and Carolyn Lee and Kay Swift. And I always felt like that was important. But my radio show came into being because a friend of mine who I had subbed with and done kind of interview stuff with, he was part of a very political station. And one of his Sundays fell on International Women's Day. They threw him out of his show because they didn't want any men in the studio.
Oh, gosh.
So he got mad and volunteered me without telling me. I have a friend and she'll come in and do my show and she'll do women stuff. And I had 3 days to put together 2 hours of music. And when I do my evening of songs, I would call it a broad spectrum, which is, I think I got it from the Bette Midler. She wrote a book a long time ago called A View from Abroad.
That's
and
great.
A broad spectrum is on every lotion, makeup thing. Mm-hmm. But I called it a broad spectrum. And it was, I think the first show, it was all women performers. But the next time I did the radio show, I said, I got to balance this up a little bit. So then it became a broad spectrum by music by women who inspire. And by that, composers, lyricists, vocalists, instrumentalists, and the men with the very good taste to play them. And they would be like in the honorable mention slot. It's cheesy, but effective. But it was cool because then when I was established and artists would reach out to me or promoters would reach out to me to play their client, I'd be like, where are the women at? Any
right.
Women writers on your project? If so, bring it. If not, maybe the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing what a game changer that was.
And they weren't used to hearing that question for sure.
It was very interesting. And also, and I tell this story, and this DJ is actually not this way on a regular basis, but it was a snapshot. Like 2 years ago, I was in North Carolina and I'm listening to my favorite NPR station in the car, as one does. I was on the road for an hour and a half, as one is. And I heard one vocalist in the hour and a half, Ella Fitzgerald. I heard one composer who was a woman, Kate Dunton. Mm. And it was one of those things, like, I almost drove off the road going, this is messed up.
It's messed up.
It is messed up. This is, and I finally just said, gentlemen, you've got to do better. Mm-hmm. You got to do better. And the cool part of my job, when you reached out to me and you sent me Michelle Ann May and Galen McKinney and is it Pam Wise?
Pam Wise. Yep.
These great composers and players from Detroit. And I was just like, this is cool. And I had like different cities in LA. I had a toehold in LA with singers, but then there were all these incredible West projects. There was a woman named Samantha Boschnack, who had written a whole piece on the writings of Nellie Bly, the reporter. Mm-hmm. And it was so cool. And it just, that kind of stuff where I was just, and then in Canada, Chelsea McBride's Socialist Night School. And she worked with vocalists also, and just some incredible stuff. And Alison Miller's Boom Tick Boom. And I knew I'd crossed a line when one waking moment, early dawn, I woke up and it was like, what crossed my mind was, are you really playing enough Carla Bley? Are you? And I went, okay, you're nuts now. You're nuts.
It's a good kind of, like the famous John Lewis says, get into good trouble. This is good trouble. So this is what you want.
I'm a middle-aged lady of a certain age. And it was interesting that it was a little controversial what I had done. Because you're not allowed on a college radio station to get that political. They just say, we have no, at least this is what I was told in Jersey. We are not a political station. Do not bring your politics on the air.
It's impossible. And
it's also, hello, I'm a feminist that plays, does a feminist radio show. It's the music speaks what I'm about. But I decided to go to the Women's March in Washington. And all I said on the air was that I was knitting a hat, making a hat to go to Washington. Got an email from a listener going, love your music, hate your politics. You've lost my... And I was, I said, you know, what part of my format has made you feel like this is a betrayal?
Right.
And then I did some gigs and was doing a thing where I was playing. I ended it with the lyrics. It was a Jerry Lieber, Mark Stoller collection. And I ended with the song they wrote that Peggy Lee had a hit with in 1962. I'm a woman. Mm-hmm. I can wash out 44 pairs of socks and have them hanging out of the line. Mm-hmm. It's great blues. And I talked about how active Mike Stoller and his wife, Corky Hale, are with Planned Parenthood. And the fact that this song has always been a woman's anthem. And that I had just come from Washington and blah, blah, blah. And a woman came up to me after the show and just said, you had us in the palm of your hands until you started talking about that march.
Wow.
Like I was 12 years old and in high school.
What'd you say?
I'm sorry you feel that way. Never once did my eyes leave my face, but inside it was like...
It's that thing. It amazes me that people feel like they can tell you what you're supposed to say and what you're not supposed to say. That in and of itself is... Really? I can see... thinking something like, I don't really agree with that, but you had a great show. I don't need to tell you that. I don't need to tell you that.
Everybody has a choice of what they want to address with their art. And I was always told way back in the beginning, if your life is 75% politics, then your music should be as well, because that is your DNA. That's what floats your boat. What was interesting to me, just bringing to light lesser known music from the classic era of Great American Songbook, almost in many ways, that was enough. The fact that there were certain women writers, Mary Lou Williams, the fact she wrote, she has a huge catalog, but the fact that she wrote What's Your Story, Morning Glory, and then 10 years later, Black Coffee is written by the same lyricist with another composer, and she was able to go to court and prove that the melody was hers. Mm-hmm. But she took $300 and gave up the writer's credit. And Black Coffee, of course, is a standard. And that was a word I found. There are certain writers that, what's the gentle expression? They were litigious. Lil Green was litigious. Like, they would go to court and fight for their material to be heard so they could get paid. Peggy Lee going to court against Walt Disney to get the video rights for Lady and a Tramp.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the apocryphal part of the story. The image of her sitting in a wheelchair in the courtroom going, Walt would want me to have that money. And she went up against Walt Disney and she won. For me, it makes me focus on different songs. There's a pianist, Yoko Miwa, has a new album out. And one of the songs she has is a song that was a folk song. It was a traditional melody, but there was a woman that made it like a folk song thing that was like sung. And then Led Zeppelin did a cover of it.
Mm.
And she went to court to sue for the right, and she won.
Okay.
And so it's interesting because I just do a little bit of my little nerdy internet digging. And then suddenly I go, what an interesting choice for a jazz pianist to find that specific song with that specific story about a woman that fought so that she could be counted and paid. That kind of stuff floats my boat.
That's great. It's great stories. I hadn't heard any of those stories. And I don't know that much about all of those artists. And I know some about Mary Lou Williams. I have some collections of her work that I really like. Peggy Lee, I know some of her stuff, but not that much of it. If you weren't born in that era, you're not going to hear it that much, unfortunately.
I ended up, when I came to New York, because I went to a theater school. I didn't go to a grad school. I didn't go to a conservatory. I learned all my stuff on the street or on the gig, messing up on the bandstand.
Okay.
Old school. I was part of a big band for 20 years, and the guy just refused to fire me and would parties and weddings. And
What band was that?
This was Art Lillard's Heavenly Band.
Okay.
And I had to build a book. And if I didn't know a standard, the musicians just look at you. And they're like, you should. And I would learn 12 songs and then we'd go on, get another party. And then he would call 12 more that I'd never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have to go home and learn those because that's learning on the bandstand.
Right.
And learning that all that prejudice about singers are stupid, singers aren't musicians. I went back to taking piano again. I went back so I could write my own charts and so that I could learn the language, so that I could stay alive on the job. But even that prejudice is still alive.
It's completely unfounded. Completely unfounded.
And it colors what I play because I will always have a fondness for wordless scat.
Mm-hmm.
I will always have a fondness and a respect for people who can write vocalese. Annie Ross, God rest her soul, the importance of Twisted.
Yes.
It was written in 1952. This is before the feminine mystique, but women are going to, this is post-World War II, and women are going to psychiatrists because they're depressed. Mm. And they're bored stupid.
Yes.
But instead of dealing with what's to come, as far as getting them out of the home, they get put on tranquilizer.
And the flip side of that is, if you weren't a middle class person, because this isn't even race based, if you weren't a middle class
completely
or upper middle class person, you didn't have this issue because you had to work.
Or on another thing, one of the most chilling articles I read about Carla Bley was she at one point went into psychoanalysis and her psychiatrist said, you think you're a composer? Maybe you should look into getting a lobotomy.
Whoa.
Yo.
Okay.
She didn't.
No
Thank
kidding.
Goodness.
Yeah.
But you see where I'm going with this. So it's funny. I come from a long line of repressed, bitter women.
Seem to preach. much, but there is something that I want to say, a message that I hope will reach the people who are throwing life away. I call it my philosophy. That is why I pass it on to you, because it works so well for me and helps me get away from strife. Hope you'll listen carefully. They say that truth will make you free, and that's the way you want to be. 'Cause sister, this is your life. Long as you're living, always remember, time is for spending, but there's an ending while you are sleeping. Lifetime is creeping. Wake up and taste it. Foolish to waste it. Sample and savor all of its flavor. 'Cause sister, this is your life. Long as you're living, always remember, folks who are lazy are playing crazy. Better keep moving, keep on improving. You won't be hurried after you're buried. Live every minute, put yourself in it. 'Cause sister, this is your life. Me get away from strife. I hope you'll listen carefully. They say that truth will make you free, and that's the way you want to be. 'Cause sister, this is your life.
You should be a composer. That's a blues if I ever heard one.
Well, it just became important not to run around sitting there going, men are horrible. They're not. But it's that thing of just, you're going to have to find your way. You have to find your way. You find your strengths. You find your team. You find your world. You find, it's like building an improv. You find your groove. Mm-hmm. You find an interlocking. You find a harmony, you find some percussion.
And that's one of my favorite games with Rhiannon is, what was it called? Mystery Band or?
Yeah.
When I do workshops, we still play Mystery Band.
I love Mystery Band.
That's one of my favorite things in the world. And for those listening, it's a game that Rhiannon developed in her book, The Vocal River. She talks about it, but there's certain parts that everybody is assigned, and somebody starts, I think it's called the motor.
Yes.
I think it's Mystery Band. And I'm confusing because there's orchestra, there's Mystery Band, there's a couple of different things, but they're all similar idea. And somebody will start something, and then the person next to him does a part that's either a harmony or a contrapuntal, meaning like a counterpoint kind of a melody, or a harmony, or a different rhythm, and then there's choices, and then somebody does a solo on top of that. But with Mystery Band, the person who's doing the soloing chooses, a song before all of this starts that they're going to sing. It's a written song, a well-known song. And so you never know what you're going to have to sing this song on top of. So it really pushes your ability to sing melody and use your harmony to make it work and weave in rhythm to make that in the lyrics work with that new background. So
you would have to stay available. You would have to really listen.
Yeah.
And that thing that she would always say that Bobby had always said to her, just say yes.
Yep.
Don't fight. Just say yes.
Just say yes.
And see where it takes you. And I took that with me to the wilds of North Carolina. And I said it was such a gift because it's what George Gershwin says, that life is largely most interesting when you improvise, and that all these tools are not that self-indulgent, that you can take this frame of mind and change direction, change your mind, change somebody else's mind.
Yeah. If you're singing what I say, quote unquote, correctly, that's what you're doing. Cause it's an art form in the sense art is made to make people think about something in a different way and experience something in a different way. And the experience for some people, like when you're looking at fine art and you look at either a piece of sculpture or an installation or a video or a combination of those in performance art or some avant-garde music, or if you've just never heard scat singing before or bebop and you don't know what the hell you're listening to, it might just sound like noise to you. And you're like, huh, so that's reaction. But it's a reaction. It got you involved at that moment. And we're not used to that anymore because we look at screens all day and there's no reaction. Now, in the Black community, that's never been true. We always answer back to the TV. We always answer back. If we go to a Black church, you always hear everybody say, uh-huh, yep, amen, or whatever. But
ever go to a movie in Times Square?
Or to a movie, yep. If you go to a movie, we will talk to the screen. We always respond. So we interact. That's part of our culture. And it's the basis of the blues is call and response. That's part of African culture. It goes that far back. It's still here. But we still do it to the movies, to the TV screens. My girlfriend constantly is laughing at me because I'll be watching a movie and talking to the screen. She's like, who's in there with you? Nobody. Are you on the phone? No. But that's my way of interacting with art. It's just the way it is. I've toned it down some because if I'm someplace with other people, I try really hard not to do that. But
I grew up in the Riverside Church in Harlem. Mm-hmm. My dad was in medical school up the way, and my mom had been a lapsed Catholic, and they were trying to find a church for their children. And the Riverside Church, it was a very cool church in the 60s. It was a great church to grow up in because it was Rockefeller funded, but in the Sunday schools, there weren't a lot of white kids. There was like me and the minister's kids and maybe some of the teachers, but it was a very different experience. It had great music program and it had theater all this extra curricular stuff, theater programs and stuff like that. And it was great. And and my dad, then when he was working, he got a job down at St. Vincent's Hospital in Greenwich Village in the 60s. So I was seeing a very different side of New York as a very young child. I was going to church in Harlem, and then I'd be down in the village with my dad watching a circus unfold on the streets, guys in leather togas walking their dog. It was crazy. And it was just an amazing, I just thought of New York as a magic land. And I'm the only one in my family that lives here and is like a passionate, happy New Yorker. But there's something about us that's not right. We thrive on discomfort. We thrive on argument. And yet that thing of what is a perfect world? The subway, who is on that car? Subway is mixed. Subway is all different ages and races. And some people don't smell good. And some people have no job to go to. And some people spent the night there. But we all have to get someplace and we're all going to put up with one another. I try to explain to my husband's family in North Carolina, it's almost like an enforced tolerance, but it was a great way to experience the world, even if I feel like I was brought up with a naivete of course that makes sense. Of course, that's the world. That's the way it has to be. And not understanding how limiting other parts of the world could be.
Well, yeah, if you've never seen something, then you have no idea what it looks like or it could look like. Unfortunately, a lot of our world leaders think the same way. A lot of our city leaders think the same way. A lot of our town leaders think the same way. A lot of our school leaders think the same way. A lot of our church leaders think the same way. So it's the microcosm in a lot of places is this is the world, this little thing that I can see through the pinhole that I'm looking through. And then if you go outside, because is it Mark Twain that was talking about the only way to know about the world is to travel?
Oh, yeah.
Because you don't know anything but what in your little circle. Mm. You have to go outside of it.
And it's funny, even in the theater, even the kind of shows like my dad would go see, they would go to see Shakespeare at Lincoln Center, but that was Joe Papp's time when mixed casts. You would see a Twelfth Night and Maria was black and the Duke was black and it was a mixed cast, colorblind cast is what they used to call it. So that's theater. That makes sense. The idea that there were parts you couldn't play because of race or sex or
the idea we have. And it's very real. In some part, I'm of a certain age too. So it's like, it would be hard for me to watch a woman's part. Like, I have a really hard time with Tyler Perry playing an older black woman and taking that role away from an older black woman who could play the part. There are several out there who could probably do it because they understand being an older black woman. And yes, they can be over the top too. But I'm sure he enjoys that character. It's a lovable character. It's a hilarious character. You got enough money, Tyler.
And it also sidesteps the whole thing of certain crossing norms like drag perform. It's a gray, let's put it this way, it's a gray area. In the movies now, you have a movie about Billie Holiday and you have a movie about Ma Rainey. Mm-hmm. And being very partial to Ma Rainey, who was eclipsed by Bessie Smith. Ma Rainey was a really force. Both Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith were bisexual. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, like Duke Ellington, made their own, they traveled their own thing. They had their own trains. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't have to deal with not being able to pee somewhere or stay in a hotel. They were just like, I'm making my own world. The thing I like about Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is just the fact that, and they've tamed down a lot of her rough edges. I mean, she was a pants wearing diesel of a woman. Mm-hmm. And the fact
gun toting too, I believe.
Baby.
Yeah.
You know,
I think she shot what she had at one point. She had a husband and she shot him for playing around with one of her women or something like that.
I always liked the fact that Nina Simone shot a neighbor because he was disturbing her while she was practicing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times I've wanted to do that. Nina Simone is another one who could not get accepted to a classical conservatory, which is why she went into jazz. And a lot of what was going up in Harlem for musicians who were not allowed to go downtown, but the white musicians would come up to Harlem after their jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's where the hot music was.
That's where it was. My uncle, Roland Hanna, he went to, I think he was at Juilliard or the other school.
Manhattan School of Music or?
It's one of the, I can't remember the other, which, but it was something like Juilliard. It was one of those of the top echelon. And they would not teach him jazz. So he just would go work at the clubs. Yeah. And then I think he just left after a while because he was getting more gigs playing jazz than he would ever do playing classical stuff. So he just left. Mm-hmm. But so many instrumentalists got taught that. We don't teach that here.
And yet Bach was an improviser.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mozart. Can you imagine Mozart playing jazz?
Oh, God.
If he had jazz during his time. Oh my gosh. That'd be something, boy. Would have changed everything.
It's what's been interesting even now, even in this last wave of Grammys and stuff, which are always frustrating, and I can't go there.
The video.
I'm referring here to the 2021 Grammys with Cardi B on the stage, looking like she is a stripper in a strip club, very, very porn-like.
Everybody's trying to sell a record, and it's whatever sells. And all I can think of, it's terrible. How can I word this delicately? Is that it seems like people are always willing to pay to watch women be sexual.
Yes.
But you don't see men getting paid to do overtly sexual things that don't involve violating women. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the way I can put it. It's just interesting. It's just an observation. And yet, on the other hand, Who Stole the Show, doing a very classic, tasteful, God bless Bruno Mars, man, that WAP, fine and dandy. And then on the other side of it was, I'm leaving the door open. And your imagination can do the rest. Which one is right? It's just two schools of thought.
Sure.
And also because I'm older now, when I was young, the whole sexualization of young girls, that's a whole other platform. But the one thing, when I was a teenager, I was really stupid. I was really stupid and a lot of mistakes because I didn't know better. And it's part of being young. I wouldn't be 20 again if you paid me. I wouldn't be in my 20s again if you paid me. Even for the skin and the jawline and all that stuff, it's like my head when I was in my 20s, not good.
And yet people still want to be vampires.
Well, you know, that's like being a mermaid. Being a mermaid would be cool. You know, that's a whole other archetypal thing. I'm actually excited by watching the categories blur. Nowadays, I have to go to a Grammy ballot and really look for people because you never know where they're going to end up. But the fact that Robert Glasper ends up in the R&B category, that's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
The fact that Esperanza Spalding gets New Artist, the fact that Gershwin's World won a Grammy, that kind of stuff is amazing and exciting when that happens. And the fact that as a DJ and the new writing that crosses my path, and that with the young composers and songwriters, there's a very gray area that almost is what I would say singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
Is it folk? Is it jazz? Is it classical? It kind of...
Now, how do you see that going now? Because I know, as a composer myself, all of these genres have touched me and I put those things into my music. So there might be a transition that's completely R&B or funk, but it's a jazz tune, or there's a classical piece in there. What do you do with that?
There's definitely music that I'm driven by melody. But I'm not adverse to what I call, as my husband would complain if I did too out a show, he's, what's with all those pianos falling downstairs? What the hell is that? You know? That having there's a play, a lot of some of it that's subjective. I've been plagued by the jazz police, which I have no patience for. I like to let artists wander. Cassandra Wilson, Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, my goodness. One of the last live things I saw was The Ogress.
I didn't see that.
Oh my God. It was a fairy tale she came up with about an ogress that eats children, and a guy that goes to the village and says, I will woo her and kill her for you. And it's the story of their court, their relationship. And it's just Cecile McLaurin-Salvant and a full band behind her. And she tells this thing, and she just amazes me because of her choice of material runs the gamut from Blanche Calloway and Growlin' Dan to her own stuff about a mythological creature who eats children. Mm-hmm. And I just go, that's hip. That's pretty cool. But I like that open-minded thing. I get inspired more that way. Even as I love things like trad and traditional blues and things that are definitely well-defined within their peripheries, but to the challenge of trying to, in a two-hour show, to walk people into an interesting house and with lots of different rooms with memories and pictures and mementos. And I think, to me, that's cool. That's when you're sitting with your friends going, have you heard this, man? And did you hear this guy, man? Oh, my God, did you hear this? That's so cool. And it goes all over the map.
It does. When you're picking music for your recordings, that's how you go about it. Would you like to hear these things together in a specific form? And that's how you decide what's...
I try to include a pretty fair balance of vocalists to instrumentalists. I think the instrumentalists get the shortest of shrifts. And original composers, where they're like, where's the Charlie Parker at? Where's Marilyn? And you're like, there's a place for all of that. Just there's a place for the standards, but there's all this other stuff. Where have you been? What do you see? What do you hear? And different instrumentalists, incredible women sax players, Roxy Koss and Claire Daly and a whole bunch of Barry sax people. Got a bunch of trombonists and you're just Naomi Moon Siegel from the West and just trying to make an interesting collage of just, you may have only heard a snippet of her composition on an NPR All Things Considered kind of thing where you suddenly go, ooh, let's put this, it's like serving a meal.
Sure.
You know, like when you put together a club act or a night, you're trying to like, it's what's in your spice rack. What are you serving this evening? It's not going to be everything in the refrigerator. It's going to be a certain dish. And try to mix old and new. Try to mix a little history. It's hilarious right now. It's Women's History Month, which at a broad spectrum, it's always Women's History Month. That's fine. Birthdays, old and new. Things are going on in town. It used to be who was gigging where. Sometimes it was just things like Nat King Cole's birthday just passed and he had a centennial, but Nat King Cole had some pretty interesting, he recorded Mary Lou Williams written stuff. There's a whole concept album he did called Wild at Heart. That was a man and woman writing team or Wild as Love that he was very partial to. And you don't hear as much about those teams of writers. Some of them were married. Some of them were just teams. And one of my favorite standards is over 100 years old now, which is Shine On, Harvest Moon, which is written by a man and a woman. And I marvel at some of these tunes now that they've passed, they're in the public domain. And you just go, dig that. That is so cool. That is so cool. And if you do any digging in the 20s, Gershwin and Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern were certainly obsessed with what they called defining the American voice. But you also had Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey and women you would not, that were even some that came out of the minstrel shows that moved to regular vaudeville, but they were blues shouters and incredible, incredible, and just as vibrant. You know, there's the Blanche Calloway story. Cab Calloway had an older sister, Blanche Calloway, and she had a band, Blanche Calloway and her Joy Boys. But the music business could not handle two Calloways, and you do the math. And I first heard Blanche Calloway because I met Cab Calloway's daughter, Chris. And Chris, who had a smile like her father's, and I watched her lead a big band. She had it. And with the Calloway legacy, and this is no diss on the people that are keeping that legacy alive, it still fell to the men to lead the band. And Chris is gone now. She died of cancer. And I think of her and I remember her talking about her Aunt Blanche. So that when Cecile McLaurin-Salvant was wise enough to cover Growl and Dan, she gets extra points for that. Whether she knew or not how significant it was. Ida Cox is another one. Bonnie Raitt with Sippy Wallace. The rock world reaching back and making sure that there were blues artists. Wasn't it Janis Joplin who made sure Bessie Smith had a grave, had a headstone?
I think it was. Yeah, it makes a difference.
Attention must be paid.
Yeah.
And I'd much prefer it to always be like the subway. That it's a mix and that it's from many lands. Even New York in the 19th century, which was one of the most racist, the draft riots were one of the worst and most violent lynchings in the 1860s. It was around the beginning of the Civil War. But at the same time, you have Irish and Black immigrants dancing together, mm-hmm. sharing rhythms from two different parts of the world.
This is what I wrote. I wrote a song about that called Fiona's Cousin, which is exactly about that. And it was about the two different rides over on the boat. And then they came together in different places. And that's what came out of it.
Yeah, that Nina Simone song that is so wonderful that you did with Michelle Anne May, that Four Women.
Oh, yeah.
That was so cool. Oh, my God. And it's funny because I've certainly gotten recordings from white artists doing Four Women, and I go, really? Sometimes you just have to dial it back.
I don't know. There's some things like you don't remake Janis Joplin. There's no reason to do that. You can pay homage to her, but you don't remake her because you can't.
Nor can you try to slot Aretha Franklin.
Right.
Who could do everything.
Right. You can't. It's just certain things you just don't do. So that's just a musicianship thing, I think. It's just showing respect and knowing and having an ear enough to know that you can't do that. If you do a song that they have done, you have to do it completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're saying, I'm playing homage to them. I'm doing it my way. And that's fine. But you cannot try to imitate it. And that's just ridiculous. You have to do something different.
It's been interesting to watch. I always give people points these days for dipping into the what I call the pop icon. Because mm-hmm. pop songs are sloppily written, not good structure.
It depends on the pop song, though. Yeah,
true. There is that. And because also coming out of Motown, which was a lot of jazz-based stuff, coming out of Brill Building writers, that's the last gasp of what I would call Tin Pan Alley structured writing. What? But then you get into, I love the Motown story with Stevie Wonder. It was women producers that were able to keep Stevie on track in the beginning, Sylvia Moy and Suze Green and these people that later on he was going to be what he was going to be. But sure. In the beginning, he had some help from the women.
His mother even co-wrote, I think, Science Hill Delivered, I believe. But yeah, the best writing I've seen lately has been country songs. And just in the last, I would say, 15 years, maybe even 20, some of the best songs have been coming out of the country music. And those are pretty much crossover pop songs now. But they're still better written than a lot of the things that would be quote-unquote pop songs. So I don't know what's going on with that exactly. That's just my opinion.
I think it's the vision of whoever is like helming the project. Joni Mitchell is covered a lot now in the jazz world by men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always welcome because her stuff is hard to sing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes just the structure is really weird. One of the most exciting live performances for me was finally being able to see Billy Child's Laura Nero project. I loved Laura Nero in high school, but to see what he did with that project live with full string cello and bass and violin and then a rhythm section and three vocal but his take on Laura Nero was so interesting because he just said her characters were iconic. They were archetypes. Mm. She almost writes like opera. Oh my God, who would have thought that? And then stuff takes flight in a different way, which is how a song becomes immortal so right. that it can be done again and again differently and always be fresh. I always just go, surprise me. Don't just impress me with your pipes or your playing. Surprise me. What do you see? What do you hear? What do you feel?
Mm-hmm. What is your next musical project going to be, do you think?
Some of it is like picking up some lost threads. My last gig, in the last 2 years, I've lost my mother and my father, which colored a lot of how much I was performing because I was knee deep in that kind of intense caretaking thing. But I had just started to get back on track and I was resurrecting a project that had been dormant for about a decade, which was this weird art project done by Lieber and Stoller, recorded by Peggy Lee, called the Mirrors Project. And Lieber and Stoller were not they were pop icons, and so they weren't taken very seriously in the theater world. And they have a trunk full of art songs, theater songs for projects that were never, and they were always dark and they were always weird. And I fell into them back in the aughts, and it was an interesting little experience, and then it was put aside. And then I wanted to go back to it, and we looked at the arrangements, we added a violin, but what had been interesting was that the whole world had changed. Mm-hmm. The world had gotten darker. The world had gotten more fatalistic. The world had changed, and I had lost my dad. So it was an amazing thing to be a part of. And then I think I did it for Women's History Month last year, and I did it for Peggy Lee's centennial, because the only two artists I could think of that could do justice to this project were either Peggy Lee or Carmen McRae. Mm-hmm. Just saying. And not songs for young women, these are deep and dark and delicious. When the world shut down, Peggy Lee Centennial was pretty much taken off the map. So the Mabel Mercer Foundation, that was going to do like a big Peggy Lee thing, they're going to do a virtual thing, but I have to cough up something from the Mirrors Project as a video thing. And that'll be like the first time I get together with musicians in a studio now that I've been fully vaccinated. It's in a couple of weeks. And it's a way of picking up the thread and looking at what's laying there. And I'm not going to feel comfortable playing live until the most vulnerable person can walk into a club and be safe. It's important to start singing again. It's important to, I know you play bass ukulele. I play ukulele.
I pretend to.
I think bass ukulele is cool. I know one bass player who plays bass ukulele. And for a while after my mom died, I couldn't sing at all. It was just too painful. But I would pick up the ukulele is such a great instrument because it's about the size of a cat. Mm-hmm. And you can hold it in your arms, and it's an impossible instrument to be depressed when you play it. And I also, having been an East Village girl, have gotten much pleasure going to like punk cabarets where mad people play ukulele and sing nihilistic punk songs. That just floats my boat.
That's fantastic.
I just love it. And some people who do like the Keith Moon thing, and they would show up with a plastic ukulele, do a Keith Moon thing, and then destroy the ukulele. Then it just becomes theater. But it was good for me. I wasn't in a hurry to perform online. The idea of suddenly being the size of a postage stamp on somebody's phone, I just was really. But what's happening now is I'm starting to reconnect with musicians, starting to reconnect. What are you doing? How are you doing it? And as we said, there was a time in 2008, 2009, during the recession, where suddenly a friend of mine was singing off a fire escape when the High Line opened a cappella. And I was privileged enough to be invited to be a part of that, which was like you stepped in, you got to do every New Yorker's fantasy of singing off a fire escape to an audience. And we did. We sang. We did a French show. We all wore berets and smoked cigarettes. And we had a stripper, a burlesque dancer, excuse me. We had a woman singing Brecht and Vile in a rainstorm. It was the street theater thing. So that when people were starting to sing off their fire escapes during the pandemic, we've done that. But it's a very good thing to do. Mm-hmm. I recommend it highly. That kind of work with what you got and keep making music. Go, people who I know who lost all their gigs and are incredibly respected in the jazz world are back busking in Central Park and glad to do it. And because you have to make music or you'll die.
Yeah, I think I've spoken to a lot of people that basically found out that they have to perform. They're just like, I can't sit here and not do this anymore. I have to perform somehow. So it's a thing. I'm good with not performing, but I love to perform. What do? I just do this.
I will say the radio show helped me through. And also it would seem to be the thing I was supposed to do because it just falls out of me. Mm-hmm. You know, that thing when you go, what is talent? Talent is the thing that you can't explain how you do it. It's right. Like breathing. Right. It's the thing that falls out of you. It's why some people who are great vocal improvisers, it's part of their talent. They can't explain why they know how the next note goes, but it's part of their talent.
Well, you develop the things that interest you. So you'll try it, whatever that is. 10 different mm-hmm. ways until it's like, oh, that works. Okay, I remember that. Now what about this thing? And you go over here, but you only do that with the things that you love.
That was the other thing. What colored the radio show was singers on radio shows don't get a lot of shrift, so I give them a little extra attention. Women instrumentalists don't get enough attention. Let's put it that way. It's always like this. The venues are few and the knives are sharp.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just a way of opening up the playing field. And also the thing of, if I was going to do a jazz radio show, what was going to make my show different?
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to two women DJs that I respected at, I guess it was at that time, it was called the Jazz Connect, but now it's the Jazz Congress. It was what became of the IAJE.
Okay, sure.
And there was always a jukebox.
International Association of Jazz Educators. Okay.
Which is one of the few places where jazz artists could come and hang with promoters and radio people and record people, which is very important because you're all, where are you at? What are you hearing? What's going on with you? You want to know. And when I had the interview for the radio station, I went up to these two women DJs, one from the Midwest and one from the West Coast. And I just said, I have this idea. Is it dumb? The idea of calling it a broad spectrum and women writers and composers. And they both got very excited and just said, go for it, do it. But that meant so much to have that kind of support, that it wasn't stupid. And it's been, like I said, it's been very exciting, especially with young artists that reach out to me and say, I have a new album, I have a new thing. And I'm just like, oh, that's so cool. Send it to me right away. I can't wait. Good for you. Everybody needs somebody in their court going, good for you. That's so cool. If I was a young person, if I could turn back the clock, what I needed most when I was young was an older person going, the world is insane. You're going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks for being that person. Hey, you're doing it for me and you're not that much older than I am. So thank you.
You need to get back on the radio. I'm excited about this podcast. I've loved the shows that I've heard. And also, you sent me a lot of artists I didn't know about. And that also is like the woman connection. People sending me other composers, other players. Do you know about this one? Do you know about that one? So that now there's a little network in London, and there's Canada, and there's LA, and there's Seattle, and there's Detroit, and there's Florida.
Send you some Brazilian people then, because I don't necessarily know them, but I know of them. And
that's my weakest link. And I get that from all the Latin DJs. Play more Latin. You have to play more Latin jazz.
Yeah.
And they are right. I do the best I can, but I don't play enough.
Tanya Maria, baby. She's awesome. I love her. She's one of my, just throw it out there. Love her for years. I pretty much own everything she ever recorded. And if you listen to her, you'll know where I get some of my stuff from. So.
I miss singing with you. I really do.
Oh, me too. Me too. Well, when this pandemic is finally over, I'll have to come back and visit so we can do that. So that'd be awesome. And we'll record it. So we can play it back and say, listen, remember that time we did this?
So I did it. The last time I ran away to Los Angeles, which was 2016, I did a long walk and talk with Kate Gallard and another one who she will always sing. And her strength and her tenacity is a power of example.
Mm-hmm.
So must we all.
She brought us together. And I think everybody looks back on that fondly because we did have a blockbuster group. We really did, because we went to that Rhiannon workshop, and then after that, it was like almost a year or 2 years that we were meeting on a regular basis.
But, and also even in Rhiannon's class, I can remember when you would pair off with a singer and do an improv together, like somebody would sing the melody of a standard and the other person was working around them or something. But the vibe where you could, it was like having sex with people. It was like some people you really could gel with.
Yes.
And you were in sync and it was happening and it was going to happen. And other people, not that they weren't talented, not that they weren't, but it just never.
Yeah.
I remember I had a teacher that used to say all-star bands weren't necessarily always good
mm-hmm.
because they weren't always, it didn't guarantee that they would be in sync with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I call those kinds of club dates with musicians that I don't totally gel with. I just say, oh, that was bad sex. That just didn't work.
There's just moments sometimes. Yeah, you just have to go, okay, and end scene. So, yeah, but.
See, but then you can take that into your real life. And you just, when suddenly you're in a situation, even not like on a day job, and it's like, awkward. And you just suddenly have to go, how is the gracious way of handling this?
Yes, how do I get out of this? Stop now. Cut. Hey, I've done that with my live band because that was our whole thing. We just start something. And sometimes it takes a minute to gel, but once we get something, we lock in and we're fine. But there's been moments where it never locked. And we're like, and then I'll just have to be like, okay, and done. Next. And I'll just stop us and we'll start something new right away. And it's all good. So
makes sense. It's that thing of just,
it's awkward when it happens.
Yeah, yes, it is. It's for vocalists, so rarely do we get a chance to even have that opportunity to communicate that way. And instrumentalists, they're doing it the minute they're in band. And then you get into that thing of, geez, if everybody could pick up the saxophone, if Congress could just be in a band and like this group are like the drummers and this group is, it's an interesting thought, actually. It would be an incredibly atonal experience right now. But
yeah, because one side doesn't want to, they want to cover up their ears altogether, and the other side wants to do the same thing, and it's problematic.
I love American music, and I love it when people are able to play together.
Mm-hmm.
All different kinds. But then now I sound like an old hippie, so we'll just stop that right there.
It's all good. Where can we find you online? Where's the Broad Spectrum?
The radio station is out of Fairleigh Dickinson University. So that's www.wfdu.fm.
Okay.
And they have an HD2 channel, which is their eclectic. There's a handful of jazz shows on that. You can hear a Broad Spectrum on Sundays from 3 to 5. The archive shows are on mixcloud.com/broadspectrum. And that's where all the archive shows live. And also allaboutjazz.com, God bless them, which is a great website for 1,000 things. It's great for reviews and news and who's where and who's what. But they also profile some good jazz radio stations. And they reached out to me too. So they will also include the link to my Mixcloud show, and it's all good. And I'm on Instagram @mfconklin. I'm on Twitter @a_broadspectrum, and I'm on Facebook as a personal person, as a singer, and also there's a Broad Spectrum page where the playlists live. Yeah, and I have a website, maryfosterconklin.com. I'm trying to make it easy so that you can find. And I'm on YouTube. But that place where I've got like old YouTube and new YouTube. So okay. Trying to make that kind of get together. And I've done my best. You can, if you Google Mary Foster Conklin, you'll find me.
We'll find you. Okay. And that's definitely what I wanted to know. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you for doing this great podcast. Long may you wave.
Oh, really?
It is a cool thing. And please send all my respect to all these great artists in Detroit. I'm so impressed with so many of them, and you are all just great players. And it really leaves me in the dust, all the talent that's coming out of Detroit. So I won't let anyone talk trash about Detroit.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website, tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts. We really appreciate your comments and will mine them to bring you more amazing episodes. I would like to thank this inaugural season sponsors, the folks at Jazz Alliance of Mid-Michigan, or JAM. Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, is a partner in supporting the Tia Time podcast and Sham Bones Music. Without their support, this podcast would not be possible. Thank you so much. If you would also like to contribute to the show, you can find us on patreon.com.
If you want to continue the conversation about topics discussed in the show or start new ones with like-minded people, join us at the Tia Time Lounge on Facebook. Thank you for listening. See you next week at Tia Time.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website at tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts to expand the reach of the show. We really appreciate that help. And we'd also like to say thank you so very much to our sponsors, Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, and Cold Plunge Records. And also all of our Patreon supporters. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. We'll see you next week at Tia Time.